Call the Agriculture Finance and Housing Conference Committee to order. Members, welcome to the conference committee, to the audience. Our intention today is to go through the finance and the policy, the side-by-sides, and also we've had a few people that have subscribed or signed up to testify on the bills, and we'll take our intention is to take that as well and keep moving along. So with that, I guess why don't we turn it over to Senate Counsel Mr. Mueller, if you want to start going through the financial side by side, and then we'll just continue on with the policy. Members, I guess if it's a raging question that needs to be asked while we're going through, that's fine, but otherwise try to just write it down, and we'll come back to questions after we conclude, if that makes sense. So, all right, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, you're working off the spreadsheet that should be in everyone's packet. It's a spreadsheet that the House put together, and then there's an addition on the end dealing just with the Agri program. And so we'll go through that at the end. But basically, the Senate overall had a zero target on the Ag budget. They actually make a $300,000 net reduction to the Department of Ag, and then there's a $300,000 increase to AURI. So that gets us to a zero general fund target, and that's what the Senate was working off of on this budget. So starting on the spreadsheet, and Mr. Savory and I will sort of jump back and forth as we go between House and Senate proposals here. But the spreadsheet, we'll be working off the mostly the lines that say on change items. And the first item, I'll let the Mr. Savory start with the House has some of the first items here.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'll start on line 37 on the spreadsheet, the first change item in the House side. If you look on the far two columns on the right-hand side, little House 1819 and House 2021, this all begins. So line 37 is the critical core capacity for plant pathogen and pest. That's a one-time appropriation of $250,000 in each fiscal year. Moving on to line 38, the Industrial Hemp Development Program is a $250,000 appropriation, split $125,000 in each fiscal year, one-time appropriation. Skipping down several lines, on line 40 is the food certificate fee account. This is the governor's change item, and the corresponding change would move some of this funding for this program to the Ag Fund. That results in a $50,000 reduction in spending each year from the general fund on an ongoing basis. And then I'll turn it back to Mr. Mueller to go over the line 41.
Mr. Chairman, line 41, the Senate and the House have similar provisions dealing with the noxious weed grants. The Senate's proposal, and the governor also had a proposal similar, but that the governor's proposal was going to deal with the program at the agency level. This is has the money going out to local grants with the Senate and the House. That's on line 41, $300,000 per year.
And then, Mr. Chair, on line 42 is the next change item for the House. It's a general fund transfer from the general fund to the Pollinator Habitat and Research account in the Ag Fund. This is somewhat similar to the governor's proposal, but this proposal is more specifically around pollinator research, and that is a $250,000 each year appropriation, but of a one-time nature. And skipping down all the way down to line 53, there is a small appropriation to maintain current service levels at the Department of Ag from the remediation fund. It totals $14,000 in fiscal years 18-19, and then $18,000 in 2021 in the outline biennium.
Mr. Chairman, on the Senate side, on line 44, the Senate has a program of for some local grants dealing with wolf livestock conflict prevention. It's $150,000 each year in 18 and 19, and nothing in the tails. I'm going over to the next page, dealing with the house item. Mr. Chairman, the next item, on line 74, is where the House takes up the governor's proposal on the food certificate fee account, and this is a fee that will be deposited in the Ag Fund, $182,000 per year. Next change item, we have the Senate in the marketing part of the Department of Ag on line 101. Is a $100,000 one-time appropriation from the general fund for ethnic minority farmers connections.
Is that a cell phone? I'll shut mine. If anybody else has one on, why don't you shut it off just in case. All right, go ahead, Mr. Wheeler.
Mr. Chairman, then the next item we'll go through is on page 3 here, change item starting on 133.
And Mr. Chair, the first change item is a cancellation in fiscal year 17. On line 134, the cancellation of bioeconomy payments totaling $694,000. Those would be then carried forward into the fiscal year 18 to be spent. I'll go briefly through the agri section. Obviously, Mr. Mueller did note there's a page that goes more in depth on the last page of the spreadsheet about this. But overall, lines 135 is just reducing the payments to the University of Minnesota Wild Rice Breeding Program. It equals that program was at $450,000 and now will be reduced to $350,000. That program, along with the potato breeding program currently within the bill, will be then moved and folded into the AGREET language within the bill. So the AGREET rider, that's on line 137, the AGREET rider would increase by that corresponding amount. Additionally, on line 138 speaks to that increasing the AGREET program, which I just talked about, of $800,000 each year. Line 139 is a reduction to the AGREET program of $571,000 each fiscal year, and then that reduction changes slightly to $167,000 in the outline biennium.
Mr. Chair, under the, like I said, we'll go through the specifics of the AGRI program. Basically, the Senate did a couple things here. The Senate moved the, on line 167, deciding incentive payments that was in the base at $3 million per year as a statutory appropriation, has deleted that. And then there won't be any payments made in fiscal year 18 and 19. And then in the tails in fiscal year 20 and 21 has moved that siting incentive program under the AGRI program and then also added the shrimp production incentive payments under the AGRI program. So like I said, when we get to the last page, there's a little bit more detail about what the Senate has included under the AGRI program and the additional money that it has added to that. The House keeps the siting incentive payments as is under current law, and shows that on 169 that the $3 million per year would stay as a statutory appropriation as a separate line item. On the, we'll move to the next page. There's a few change items that are under the admin part of the department's budget. Line 200, the Senate has $296,000 for the Forever Green cover crop research. The Senate also has money as an aside in the clean water bill, legacy bill for this proposal. The Senate also on line 202 makes a slight general fund reduction to the admin, the administration of the Department of Ag, $193,000 per year, and that's ongoing. The Senate on line 204 and the House both appropriate $155,000 for the tractor rollover prevention grants. And then the Senate on line 205 has a $28,000 increase for farm advocates. A little note that the House also has this, but accomplishes it in a little bit different way under the Agri program, provides for some additional funding for the farm advocates. And then the Senate makes, on line 207, makes the appropriation for the Minnesota Turf Seed Council. It just makes it one time, so we're not carrying any money in the tails for that. Overall, you'll see on lines 250 through 253, the Senate's appropriation is, like I noted before, is the general fund appropriation overall to the Department of Ag is a $300,000 decrease to the Department of Ag in both fiscal year 18 and 19, and also fiscal year 2021. And the House, I believe, is a $758,000 increase, general fund increase to the Department of Ag in fiscal year 18 and 19. Next we have, you can skip a couple pages here and go to the Board of Animal Health on page 6. Both the House and the Senate have no change. The Senate has no change to the Board of Animal Health.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the House does carry an item for the Board of Animal Health at the general operating adjustment of $166,000 in the 18-19 biennium, and then that continues a $214,000 biennial adjustment in 20 and 21, and this matches a governor's proposal.
And then, Mr. Chairman, under AURI, the Senate carries an increase of $150,000 per year, a little bit less than what the governor had proposed, a $340,000 biennial increase. And the House is doing the AURI at the base level, no increase. On the last page are the totals. Again, I'll note that the Senate came in at a net general fund of zero, no increase, no decrease, for the three agencies in this budget area. In the House, you'll see on the far right column there, the House versus Senate, the total spending between the House and the Senate. The House is about $1.3 million over the top of the Senate, over all three agencies. And then the revenue changes, the Senate has no changes in fees or revenues in this bill.
And then, Mr. Chair, just describing some of the transfers and fees that are happening in the House proposal. Line 317 details that transfer that was from the Ag Emergency account to the general fund of $450,000 one time. Additionally, on line 319, this is Mr. Mueller referenced the House's position on the food certificate fee account. That just displays that revenue of $182,000 a year going forward. Dropping down on line 324, with the food certificate fee account, there's a loss of general fund revenue to the general fund that's being tracked at $110,000 going forward from fiscal 18 on to the tails. And then line 325, I referenced earlier, a cancellation of some bioeconomy payments of $694,000. That just represents the carry forward on line 325. And then on line 326, are the dollars that are transferred from the ag emergency account into the general fund. That's just the positive revenue of the $450,000 coming into the general fund to be utilized.
So, Mr. Chairman, then we'll go to the last page, and this is where we show a little bit more detail of what the Senate and the House is doing under the AGRI program. And the way this table works is it shows the current funding under fiscal year 16-17, and this would also be basically the base budget. But $10.2 million per year goes into AGRI. And then based on there's a couple programs that were specified in the current budget to get money out of the AGRI program. Those would be county fair grants, food hub grants, and biofuels incentive payments. So then the undesignated amount is shown as undesignated balance, and that's the amount that would be free for the Department of Ag to offer in other various grant programs, which are listed under that, which is livestock investment grants, value-added ag grants, farm to school, new market, crop research, biofuels, farm business management, sustainable ag, and good ag, good food handling certification. Those are all different grant programs that the Department of Ag currently operates with, and is free to decide how much money they can put into those programs. Under the Senate proposal, we move $2.3 million more money into the AGRI program, but we designate a lot of that is to be used. The biofuels incentive payments, $1.5 million per year. And this is just for fiscal year 18 and 19. $3 million per year for livestock investment grants, $3 million per year for value-added grants, and $350 for new market development, and that includes some language for hemp development, and then $1 million per year for biofuels cost share. So that would leave $2.685 million to the department to allow for other grant programs that are not specified. And then in fiscal year 20 and 21, the Senate adds an additional a little bit over $3.9 million to the AGRI program. And then again, it would go for the county fair grants, the biofuels payments, and then it would start covering the siding production incentive payments of estimated to be about $3 million per year, and then also cover the new shrimp production incentive payments, and that would estimated to be at $5 million per year. The way it would work, if those incentive payments do not go out, they would fall to the undesignated amount and allow the agency to be awarded in the other various grant programs. The House has a $571,000 reduction to the AGRI program, and it designates the $1 million per year for county fair grants, the $1.5 million for biofuels, but then it lists some additional amounts for $40,000 for farm advocates. That would be ongoing. $500,000 for a grant to Metro State, and that's one time. $500,000 ongoing for urban agriculture, and then $250,000 per year for good food access. So I just wanted to show a little bit more detail what's happening in the AGRI program between the House and the Senate and how it compares to current law. And that's it.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to go through the side-by-side language?
Mr. Knopf, why don't you do that? Let's go through the policy.
And I'll go through quickly on the appropriations part, because Mr. Mueller and Mr. Stavery did that with the spreadsheet. I might just point out a couple of things in the writers, but just to make sure that people are aware of what those are. And because a lot of these changes in the riders, the differences in the riders, are really related to the AGRI part that Mr. Mueller mentioned, and then some of the additional things that are funded on each side. One of them that I want to point out is under AGRI is that the Senate with the livestock investment grants under AGRI. The Senate actually has
page.
Mr. Chair, I am finding it now. Yeah, okay, here we go. That's the research.
Okay, so it starts from the bottom of page R7, the AGRI for both both parts. But actually the language you'll see on page R9, on 7.31 to 7.34, the Senate has language for $3 million per year for AGRI to go to livestock investment grants. And then on number 4, you'll see the $3 million per year on 8.1 to 8.3 on the Senate side. You'll see the language for that. But I also wanted to point out that on page R11, line 8.14 through 8.32, you'll see that the Senate also specifies the level of grant award. So for the value-added grants under Clause 4, they may award up to 2 grants for more significant grants for new or expanding livestock product processing facilities or dairy product processing facilities that provide significant economic impact to the region. The remaining grants are between $1,000 and $200,000 per grant. So that basically, there's like a 2 grant programs, and there's up to 2 that can be for larger facilities, and then there's the smaller grants. And so I wanted to make sure that people knew about that distinction that Senator Westrum was looking for. And then, Mr. Chair, I don't think I need to go through too much on the riders. They're basically very similar in what we do. It's just basically the financing, and that AGRI spreadsheet that Mr. Mueller went through does a better job of talking about where the various things are, the various components of that are. I will point out one thing on 14.1. It's on page R16, 14.1 of the Senate. There is a report requirement. This is an initiative of the chair of the Senate side to bring back a list of inspections the department conducts at more frequent intervals than federal law requires, and an explanation of why additional inspections are necessary. So that's an additional report that's in the riders I wanted to make sure that you're aware of. And now we get into the language parts of the bill, more the statutory and the law change sections. You can see on the compensation for crop or fence damage by elk, the House has some additional language in here on dealing with how the approved agents work. I think it's basically a cleanup of the language and allowing a little more flexibility for the commissioner in case there's not a county inspection agent in the area. Mr. Sullivan is here, so he can explain the House provisions now, if you're ready.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Knopf just described that section of the House bill accurately. It would provide the department flexibility to work with other agents beyond county extension agents when evaluating a landowner's claim for crop damage by elk.
Mr. Chair, then we can move on to page R18. Is another House-only, a farm safety working group.
Mr. Chair and members, this section 2 of the House language is from Representative Clark Johnson's House File 1192, and it essentially codifies an existing advisory group that has been working with the Department of Agriculture and providing advice regarding farm safety issues. The working group would expire on June 30th, 2021.
And Mr. Chair and members, on page R20, we have both sides have the changes to the rollover protection grant program, both sections 5 on the Senate, section 3 in the House, section 6 on the Senate, section 4 in the House, relating to the amount that can be used for promotion and administration is the same. On section 7 of the Senate and 8 and 5 of the House, we both have provisions related to notification when there's a weed on the eradicate list, although the Senate has some additional language. There's also some
technical things in the first sentence, but the Senate has additional language on the commissioner working with stakeholders to eradicate the weed in Minnesota. So there's some additional language on the Senate side. Section 8 on page R21 on the Senate side is the Senate only and has to do with compliance. It basically tells the commissioner that they cannot require an applicator to demonstrate compliance or need prior to applying the pesticide. So it's basically when they don't have to demonstrate prior to, but they still could be required to demonstrate compliance after. And then, Mr. Chair, on Section 6 on the House side, is the House only?
Mr. Chair and members, Section 6 would establish a new pollinator habitat research account in the Agricultural Fund. And any money in that account would be appropriated by statute through the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota for pollinator research and outreach activities. Then Section 7 at the bottom of R21 is House only. This was a recommendation by the Department of Agriculture to increase from $75 to $125 the fee the department charges when a person voluntarily requests an export certificate for food that's processed and manufactured in Minnesota. And remember, see on 26.1 to 26.4, then there would also be a new account created in the Agricultural Fund to hold those fees. And the receipts from those fees would be appropriated back to the Department of Agriculture to perform the certification work. Then Section 8 is House only on R22, lines 26.5 to 26.12. This section has to do with the Agricultural Growth, Research, and Innovation Program. Current law provides that the Commissioner of Agriculture, in consultation with the legislature, determines how to allocate money appropriated for the program. And under this House language, that would be changed so that the department would allocate the money as appropriated and provided by law. So it would take away some of that discretion, and then the reporting requirements are changed accordingly.
And Mr. Chair, at the bottom of page R22, we have this Senate-only provision, Section 9. This is where Mr. Mueller went through the spreadsheet and talked about the siding payments. What this does is it delays the eligibility for 2 years so that there would be no payments made during the current biennium. They can't begin before then. So that would take care of ensuring, and again, in the spreadsheet it showed that I think $3 million per year on the House side would still be there. On the Senate side, for the biennium, that would be reduced, or current biennium would not be, they would not be eligible. And then Section 10 on the Senate side, the shrimp production incentives, Senate Weber's bill, dealing with providing shrimp producers that produce at least 25,000 pounds of shrimp each quarter to be eligible. And again, they would not be able to begin production before July 1, 2019. So for both the siding and the shrimp payment, no payments would be made in this biennium, but would be eligible in the off biennium. And again, as Mr. Mueller went through the agri, that would be the source of money to pay for this. And then I won't go through the language in any detail. You can do that. I think there'll be people testifying on this. And then, Mr. Chair, so basically, this is a payment program in the amount not to exceed the amount necessary for 2 million pounds of shrimp produced in a quarter, but it provides that payment program. And then, Mr. Chair, the House only on fence law.
Mr. Chair and members, on the bottom of page R24, Section 9 on the House side, has to do with the state's partition fence law. Under current law, adjoining owners or occupants of land must share in the cost equally of erecting and maintaining a fence between the properties if one of the landowners wants the fence to be there. The change that was proposed in the House language, Representative Knobloch's House File 1006, as incorporated in this omnibus bill, would say that the requirement to construct and maintain the fence would now apply only if the adjoining lands are both used to produce or maintain livestock, either for agricultural or commercial purposes. And then the livestock would be defined, as members can see, on 26.24 to 26.26 for purposes of the law. And then the effective date would provide that this change is effective following final enactment, but only applies to those partition fences that are built pursuant to this chapter on or after the effective date.
And Mr. Chair, members, on page R25, Section 11 is the Senate only. This is the Wolf Livestock Conflict Prevention Pilot Program. which will provide grants to livestock producers to acquire basically prevention activities, including the purchase of guard animals, and then camping, labbing shelters, and other things. A program, and then they have to continue, but they also continue to be eligible for the payments for the depredation payments, but they would report annually to the commissioner on the non-lethal methods employed and then allow follow-up evaluation monitoring by the commissioner. Again, a pilot program for 2 years, and Mr. Mueller went through the money in the spreadsheet.
And page R26, section 5 on the is a house-only section. What this does is it reduces prior appropriated money in laws 2015 first special session that were for the AGRI program, and specifically within AGRI, the money that was designated for bioeconomy incentive payments. So that reduction was, I assume, discussed earlier on the spreadsheet, but the changes that correspond to that reduction of the 2017 money and the carry forward into 2018 are on lines 14.7, reduction of the roll-up number on page R27, lines 15.13 to 15.14, reduction of the second year AGRI appropriation. And on R28, lines 16.7 to 16.8, what that change is intended to do is to provide that if eligible claims under the bioeconomy payments exceed the amount that's left after the reduction, the department could use other AGRI dollars that were appropriated but not designated for a specific purpose for those payments, and then that would become part of the report back to the legislature about how much, if any, of that money was used for that purpose. And then the final change to this section is on R29, line 17.32, reduction of the bioeconomy carve-out, as we like to say, of AGRI from $1.5 million to $806,000 remaining for that purpose. Then, continuing on, R30 is still that rider that was changed, and it's been described already. On R31, at the bottom are two house-only sections, Section 6 and 7. Section 6 requires the Commissioner of Agriculture to submit a report detailing the agency's base budget, including any prior appropriation riders, to the chairs and ranking minority members of the Agriculture Committees. And this is similar to language that was enacted in 2015 in the first special session, and members are likely familiar with the resulting report. Section 7 was, I assume, discussed earlier as part of the spreadsheet. This is the transfer of money back from the Ag Emergency Account in the Agricultural Fund to the General Fund. That's a one-time transfer. And then Section 8 on the House side, again, corresponds or has to do with the reduction of the bioeconomy appropriation in fiscal 2017.
And then, Mr. Chair, we have each have a repealer, but they're very different. The Senate Section 12 repeals the statutory appropriation for the siting payments. Mr. Mueller talked about that on the spreadsheet, that instead it will come out of AGRI as being delayed for 2 years. And then the House has a Section 10 repealer.
And Mr. Chair and members, the Section 10 repealer on the House side, Section 383C.809, is a unique partition fence law standard that applies only in St. Louis County. And as members heard earlier, the House proposes to change the standard generally statewide for the partition fence law. And Section 10 would eliminate the unique St. Louis County standard that says, in essence, that in St. Louis County only, if one landowner does not have need for the fence, they're not required to pay for it.
Mr. Chairman, that's it.
That's it. Question, members, and then why don't we move to testifiers. I think we've got about seven folks that have asked to comment on the bills. So, questions, members? We'll call up Patsy Nobles with Urban Roots. If you want to come to the table, identify yourself for the record, and try to stay focused on the issues in the bill in front of us. Welcome to our conference committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Noble had to leave for a meeting. I'm Jody Bantley with Metropolitan State.
Okay. You're substituting for her?
If I may.
You may. Go ahead. Give us your name again for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, senators, legislators, I'm Jody Bantley from Metropolitan State University.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm here to represent the Planning Committee for the Growers Center, which is a community university urban agricultural gateway for research, outreach, workforce development, innovation, and teaching. Essentially, our goal is to repurpose an existing state facility, our former Department of Agriculture site that was vacated in 2008, transferred to the Minnesota state system and incorporated into the Metropolitan State University campus. A few years ago, at the urging of several community organizations on the east side of St. Paul, which some of you know has been declared by the federal government as a food desert, we've been asked to reconsider how this facility could be used. So with those community partners, most notably Urban Roots, which unfortunately Patsy isn't here to represent herself today, but others as well, and our faculty, we have worked to bridge our teaching mission as a university and their purposes as producers and educators in the community around food security, agricultural production, youth development and workforce, environmental sustainability, and agricultural education. As a learning and teaching hub, the GrowIt Center would serve as a year-round facility for scientists, learners, and producers, with an emphasis on exchanging knowledge that brings together the knowledge of practitioners and the knowledge of scientists. We have already raised $234,300 for this project, the total cost of which is estimated at $1,126,000. So we're about a quarter of the way there. Our request to the legislature for $500,000 represents about 45% of our total cost, and we have been invited by several other third-party private foundations to submit proposals within the next several months that would cover another $350,000 of the cost. So we're very close. We're very encouraged by the support from private foundations, including CHS. Agribank has asked us to come back to them. So this project could become a reality, but it's time sensitive in that the grants we have secured so far have time limitations on them. One is from the City of St. Paul and expires in February of 2019. So with an appropriation this year, we have great confidence we could leverage the resources we need to build next year and begin building next year and be open for the 2019 growing season. The impact of the GrowIt Center extends far beyond the boundaries of our campus. Our primary partner, Urban Roots, employs 60 Eastside low-income youth every year, and over 3,000 K-12 youth pass through their organization and are introduced to the best practices in urban agriculture and consciousness about healthy eating and healthy food. In addition to Urban Roots, we have earned the support of the Hmong American Farmers Association and the Latino Economic Development Center, which supports small farmers whose markets are primarily urban. We've also made contact with the Urban 4-H and the Future Farmers of America programs and have relationships in other dimensions of our university with the schools where those programs are located. So we see tremendous potential, and we need your help to get there. So we look forward to your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I see you guys took my microphone away from me, too, so I don't know if that's a sign or what. But no, I just want to thank the testifier for coming in. To my Senate colleagues, we had some very powerful testimony. We had kids come in from St. Paul from this urban roots, and they talked about the importance of this as well. And there's a number of entities that are willing to step up and fund this, but they're also taking a look at what we're going to do at a state level, if there's going to be any support here too. And the main takeaway from this is that urban youth agriculture education component. And so I just want to stress that to everybody as well. And many people have been working on this, and there's a tremendous amount of support. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a question. Long term, 5, 10 years, 15 years, what safety nets or options are in place to kind of help ensure that an investment in repurposing, rehabbing this building and greenhouse would be there long-term support? If you could just address that for us. This building is in a short 20-year history has sat idle for a good chunk of that time, and so for any of us that have concerns of long-term sustainability, could you just address that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senators, Representatives, the Metropolitan State University has made a commitment to absorb the ongoing operational costs of the building, and the building design includes solar panels that would, for the most part, according to our former dean, who sadly passed away unexpectedly this last year, but has experience in this, said would offset the cost of year-round operation. Greenhouses year-round are expensive because if you're doing research as part of what goes on there, you need to be able to control the heat and the light and the temperature year-round. So the building design would be one of the ways to lower those costs. The building would, once hooked up to our security system, would become part of the campus and its ongoing maintenance. As for the staffing, we're looking the primary staffing and the activity that would happen inside the building would come from the existing departments and organizations that are interested in partnering at the Grow It Center. So our only staffing commitment would be to a half-time greenhouse manager, someone who has that technical skill, with salary and benefits is estimated at this point at about $50,000 a year. And Metropolitan State has committed to funding that as part of our general operations for the first 2 years of operations. One of the things that we've found as we have reached out to the private sector for resources to redo the building is that many, many, many private foundations are interested in these issues of food and food security and urban agriculture, but they don't want to support capital requests. They want to support programs. So we have a high level of confidence, and Urban Roots in particular has a very impressive track record attracting funds from third-party organizations to subsidize the program. And some of the supply costs and so on are already built into the science department budgets for the next years ahead that our administration is now planning for.
Other questions, members? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the testifier, you talked about some of the staffing levels required, and I don't know if your university has specialists or people involved in agronomy, things like that, but are you looking at this more of a growing food, vegetables type of thing, or doing actual research into plants and plant growth? How do you view the role of the task of this program?
Representative Anderson, legislators, the purpose of the hub is to, in fact, be multifaceted. The design of the building right now includes three research bays because it was designed as a biological pest control research facility. our redesign with an expansion toward the street would retain one research bay so that we could, in fact, provide that kind of support to the producers with whom we have relationships and ongoing contact. Perhaps the kind of research that's of a smaller scale than what might be typically expected at, for example, the University of Minnesota. So research is part of it. Production is part of it. The other two research bays that are currently in the footprint of the building would be the walls would be taken down and it would be opened up for starter plants for production. Urban Roots produced 10,000 pounds of food last year in just under an acre of assembled lots in the urban areas. And this coming year, as part of a housing development on the east side, they've been granted another full acre. So they need a place to grow starts for the summer season, summer through fall season. And we also have a faculty member who does a master's program on community psychology that focuses on food and community building, and he too needs a place for starts. The scientists in multiple disciplines, not agronomy, but in the core disciplines of biology, chemistry and environmental science, and soils, there's a soils course, could use that facility for some of their lab work in ways that we just don't have. For those of you who aren't familiar with our campus, it's a commuter campus, and it's a very compact campus. We don't have residence halls and athletic teams and all of that. We have very limited space, but the faculty in our College of Sciences are very excited about the possibilities for enhancing the teaching and learning and lab work and research work that they can do in this facility year-round.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. In regards with the research, are you mostly looking for staff members doing that, or is that, people in the community? And any idea on research that you're looking at possibly doing? Those would be my two questions. Thank you.
Ms. Brantley.
Representative Backer, senators, representatives, thank you for that question. If I could just preface my response by saying I work in the Institute for Community Engagement and Scholarship, and our role within the university is to be a portal to the university's mission of providing a community-engaged education. From where I sit, the most exciting prospect about this hub is the potential to marry the knowledge that producers and practitioners have with scientific knowledge. So there isn't a research agenda independent of that going on at our university, but we have had, Urban Roots and others come to us and ask, can you help us, test our soils? What would be a remediation plan? What do we do with this particular pest, and so on and so forth? And it's very accessible. We're just one office, one person can go straight to the appropriate faculty. So the research could be embedded in some coursework and in the interest of the faculty, but really our intention is to be driven by the agenda of what the producers want from us. I'm sorry.
Does that answer your question?
Did that answer both of your questions? I'm not sure.
That gives me...
Chair, gives me what I need for now. Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions, members? Without Ms. Brantley, thank you for stepping in and appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mike Zabel next, and then following that, Mr. Woolman from the Department of Ag just will be on deck. So, Mr. Zabel, welcome to our committee. Identify yourself for our record, and you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Zabel. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of the True Shrimp Company, headquartered in Ballatin, Minnesota, and an affiliate of Ralco Nutrition in Marshall, Minnesota. You proceed?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is one of several times I've had a chance to present to most of you, so I'll try to be brief as I can. I'm here to speak in support of the shrimp production incentive that is part of the Senate's omnibus bill. Won't go through all the details again. And no, I didn't bring any shrimp with me. What is this for?
IOUs are okay.
IOUs and shrimp, Mr. Chair. Okay, I remember that. Before 1 cent of this incentive is paid to the investors in the harbor, $85 million of capital will have already been deployed in 4 locations in Minnesota. This spring, we're going to break ground on a training center in Battleton, Minnesota. This spring, we're going to break ground and build the first shrimp hatchery ever in Minnesota. We will then retrofit a USDA plant for processing in Marshall, Minnesota. And yes, next spring, we will break ground on the first shrimp production harbor in Minnesota. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, Novatech of Roman, Minnesota will already have constructed and installed state-of-the-art shrimp processing equipment, not only for us here in Minnesota, but to be marketed across the world. Incredible breakthroughs in the technology that they're developing. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, Action Track in Marshall, Minnesota will have put together a production line and hired people to build hundreds of robotic feeders that we will use in the shrimp production facility for the first one and those beyond. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, New Vision Co-op of Worthington and Brewster, Minnesota will be producing shrimp feed at a rate of 15 million pounds a year and growing and shipping them to the harbors. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, the University of Minnesota and their economic impact study suggested to us that just the building of the harbor alone will have a $48 million economic contribution to the 5-county area surrounding that harbor. They project 330 people will be touched in an employment fashion, and it will generate a payroll in that 5-county area of over $14 million. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, the University of Minnesota study also tells us that the ongoing operation of that harbor will have a $30 million annual economic contribution to that 5-county area and employ directly and indirectly over 124 people. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, the University of Minnesota study also suggests that we will raise the price of soybeans in Minnesota by as much as 15 cents a bushel, which is an astronomical number to me. Before 1 cent of the incentive is paid, antibiotic-free, sustainable, traceable, and I'll add absolutely delicious shrimp will be flowing into the market from Minnesota. Before 1 cent of the incentives paid, we'll be collecting what we call molt dry tissue to turn into chitosan to build yet another business idea, the production of chitosan here in Minnesota. All of this before 1 cent of the incentive is paid. So you say, Zabel, why do we need this incentive? Why do you need to do this if you've already got all these plans? The one word I've tried to use with you in all our time together is the word encouragement. We need encouragement to make the heavy investments in the shrimp production harbors. This incentive does not go to the True Shrimp Company. It goes to the investors who are going to put up $54 million for each and every harbor that we build. We need to encourage the investment in harbor and investment in a new industry. I went through my little litany to demonstrate to you just a touch of the people and the industries that are going to be touched by this effort and will be touched by this effort. This is a unique opportunity for the state of Minnesota. A little company in Marshall, Minnesota, Ralco Nutrition, has made the investment, taken the risk to take on an entirely new technology that the world is recognizing. To give you an example, our veterinarian, Dr. Jessica Fox, has just been appointed to the Aquatic Veterinary Medicine Society as part of the greater American Veterinary Medical for aquatic animals. So they're already recognizing what we are doing is out on the leading edge of production of protein, in particular shrimp. So I'm here to ask you one more time, and I'm also here to thank you for the time that you have given me and my colleagues, the support that we've had in the Senate and the House for this effort. And I look forward to your wisdom and how we possibly could get this incentive for us to build this industry. Thank you very much for your time and your attention, and you're indulging me again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zavell. Questions, members? Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zavell, I just have a question about the chitosan. Is that the correct? I don't know if I pronounced it correctly. What is that used for medically, if I recall?
Mr. Zavell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, chitosan is a natural polymer, and it is used across a multitude of industries, from wastewater treatment plants to ladies' cosmetics and to pharmaceuticals and medical devices. Because of the way we grow the shrimp, the way we feed them, and the consistent fashion that we do it, our molt tissue, the shell, when you eat your shrimp, don't throw away the shells anymore, okay, has absolutely pristine molts, and those pristine molts, and we also have the entire lineage of the shrimp, which will be important to the medical and the medical device community. Our molt tissue can be turned into medical-grade chitosan. Chitosan, for example, is a natural hemostat. It stops bleeding almost instantly. So we're working with bioscientists today that are creating battlefield bandages, a wax to use chitosan to mend bones. So there's a huge opportunity regarding
it. Representative Backer.
Chair, yeah, thank you for that. You can hear the passion in your voice. My question to you is, what type of, if all goes well, and I realize there's hiccups, what type of return are you projecting for the investors?
We are projecting for the investors in the harbor, depending upon the level of financing. I'm sorry, didn't ask for the chair. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Depending on the amount of financing, we are looking at possibly a 3-year payback for the investors in the harbor.
Thank you.
Other questions, members?
Mr. Chair
Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, what's the biggest natural threat? You talk about antibiotic-free, extremely healthy. What's the biggest natural threat to shrimp as it pertains to disease? And are we prepared for that, the Board of Animal Health or others, in the event there is ever any sort of disease threat?
Mr. Isabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for that question. The natural threat to shrimp is disease. Today in the aquaculture pond farming industry across the world, the two primary diseases are a bacterial phage called EMS and a virus called white spot. They have really no way of combating those diseases. What they are doing is using heavy doses of antibiotics in an effort to stop it. In our shrimp are not susceptible to airborne pathogens, so our challenge is to control the water. And whatever, if we control the water, they will not be susceptible to disease. At Texas A&M, in 30 years of research on this technology, they've never had disease, and we've not experienced disease in our laboratory as well. Okay, next question?
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had indicated that it's per harbor, right? Is that just a clarification on what the incentive is or what the encouragement is? Is it that we would be providing money per harbor? And how many harbors did you expect to have?
Mr. Isabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the incentive is 69 cents a pound. For the shrimp, and it is capped quarterly, I believe, at $1.2 million and $5 million annually. So the number of harbors in our plan is to build three harbors over the next 5 years. Five would be fun, too. Three harbors over the next 5 years, and those harbors would then share that incentive. Each harbor does not get $5 million on its own. It would be prorated. I believe it's to be administered by the Department of Agriculture, and it would be prorated by pounds to each of the harbors. And not only our harbors, but also there's an opportunity for other shrimp production facilities in Minnesota. answer your question.
Representative Poppy?
That's all for now.
I suppose you're wondering if they can make spam out of it, huh?
Mr. Chairman? No.
I love spam.
So do we all. Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back a little more toward the discussion of water, what do you anticipate the kind of volume of water you would need? And as soon as we mess with water in Minnesota, we get concerned about, do we recycle it? Do we put it back in the system? Can you give us a little perspective on what kind of water use and what do you do with it if you're unable to recycle it?
Mr. Zavell?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for that question. Water is a precious resource, not only to the state, but also to the business and the industry that we're trying to develop. Our harbor is 9 acres under one roof, and we'll have 42 acres of water surface. It takes 14 million gallons to fill the harbor, and that will be done quite gradually. We have to stagger start the harbor. Once we are full, now remember that water we will bring in from the local source. It will be our own, and we will put salt in it. So we have a significant investment in that water. That water will be recycled. The harbor will have its own wastewater treatment plant that could run a small city, quite frankly, on the premises with the idea of recapturing every gallon of water that we can through the system. The only wastewater we have, we believe, will come from clean and also from human waste, taking care of the people there. So we are estimating, once the harbor is full, a daily need of 60 to 100,000 gallons a day. And to give you a point of reference, that's about what it costs to water, the amount of water it takes to water a golf course during the course of our summer. But we understand that resource, and one of our key criteria as we look for locations for harbors is, do they have enough water that we don't in any way endanger that supply of water in that community?
Follow up?
No, thank you.
Any other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question then. When you talk about not having much water escape the system, would these harbors require the NPDES permit from the EPA or from the state? What kind of permitting would be required?
Mr. Zavell?
Mr. Chairman, we believe there's two significant permits that we will be engaged in. The first one will be with the Minnesota DNR, and they actually will oversee the water that we use, and then the MPCA will oversee how we use the water and what the discharge would be. And we are already in conversation with those two agencies. We've had all the commissioners of the state of Minnesota, including those, come to Ballotin to listen to my spiel, as you all have, and understand what we're going to do. And quite frankly, they don't see a lot of issues with the way we're going to do it.
Follow up, any other questions, members? Otherwise, Chair Hamilton's got a couple of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll move over to this one. I wonder if this is more of a question maybe for the authors or on the Senate side. One, I received a phone call from an individual who is a very small shrimp producer, and they asked whether or not they would be eligible for this also. And I see that it has a minimum of 25,000 pounds. And so I guess my question would be, how did we come to that number, number one, and would we be open to having others be eligible for this as well? That'd be the first question, I guess. So I don't know if that's to, maybe that's more towards us versus the testifier.
Senator Weber, do you want to take a crack at that question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, the reality of it is that we were looking at a facility that is capable of number one, producing a shrimp that is, again, as was stated in the testimony, chemical-free or disease-free, you know, that type of thing. As far as how the product would work, I think we have those limits there at this point in order to make sure that there is an investment that, quite frankly, is that justifies the money that we eventually spend in the production incentive. I think at this point, we certainly can look at that. We'd have to know exactly how far down the scale are you thinking, you know.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Weber. That was a phone call from an old Farm Bureau friend that happens to be raising shrimp now. And so they reached out to me after they had seen this legislation and wanted to know, because they would not fall into this category, so they wouldn't be eligible. So they wanted me to ask, and we can look into that further. I can get you those numbers as far as the poundage and whatnot. The second question was on the calculation of the incentive, 69 cents a pound. How did we arrive at that number, I guess? What was that the right number?
For that purpose, Mr. Chair and Chair Westrum, I would turn to Mr. Zabel. He actually has a great explanation of how that was determined. Mr. Zabel?
Mr. Chairman, may I make a comment about the previous question?
Sure, you can.
From our chair, that 25,000 pounds was largely administrative. The harbors that we are going to build will be producing in excess of 7 million pounds of shrimp a year. So as the incentive is administered and allocated by the Department of Agriculture, the idea was at what point does it administratively become unfeasible. The other thing I would add to that, members of the committee, is that it's our full intention to support small shrimp farmers. In fact, we are already getting phone calls from them asking them if we have the post larva and we have feed available for their systems, because it is very difficult for them to get both here in Minnesota. Okay?
Thank you
for indulging me on that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, regarding the 69 cents, Senator Weber says it's an easy calculation. I want you to think about it from the standpoint of mitigation of risk. In any industry, there is risk, and one of the risks of the shrimp industry is that the shrimp are a market commodity. The price of shrimp goes up and down, and it can be volatile at times, although if you notice, it steadily goes up, right? The 69 cents is the difference between our calculation of the market price that we will pay the harbor for the shrimp and the lowest price recorded in that time. So we're mitigating the fluctuation in the price of the shrimp. That's where that 69 cents comes from.
And Mr. Zavell, and I think it's you noted it, but just to highlight, the first harbor potentially could recapture 69 cents, but if as you add harbors, whether it's you, your company, or other companies that maybe also get into the shrimp production, the 5 million cap would be divided among all of them, so that incentive could become 59 or 39 or 29 cents. If you divide it by three, it would be 23 cents. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is correct. That is capped, and that would be allocated based on the tonnage of shrimp put through. We have three locations already under consideration in Minnesota for harbors.
Very good. Questions or members? Otherwise, we'll move on. Anything else? Good. Thank you, Mr. Zavell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you.
And Mr. Wallman from the Department of Ag, and Dan Scogan will be next. Mr. Wallman, I know you know the drill. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee, my name is Matt Wallman. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Commissioner Fredrickson wanted to be here, but needed to chair the Environmental Quality Board, and so he was unable to be here. I want to thank you for all of your work on the agricultural budget bill, especially you, Mr. Chair, and Chairman Hamilton. Agriculture is an important part of our economy, and we're fortunate to have chairs and members of the legislature that are highly involved in our work as an industry. The Department of Agriculture does have some concerns about the bills that are before us, but we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and Chairman Hamilton, and members of the conference committees as we work through to address these items. A couple items I just wanted to highlight for you. First, in his budget, Governor Dayton invested $10.7 million in general funds and $2.4 million in dedicated funds to help the Department of Agriculture and the agricultural industry be responsive to a dynamic global economy. Both the House and Senate bills have very low targets, zero in many cases, and additional dollars are being allocated from existing funds for initiatives in the bill. And we can talk more specifically about some of the initiatives, particularly in Agri. One of the primary concerns that we have is the Senate bill has a label compliance language that provides us very serious concerns. The proposed language has far-reaching implications for the Department of Agriculture and our Pesticide Authority and our Groundwater Protection Authority. It goes beyond neonicotinoids and seed treatments and would be applicable to all pesticides and protection of public health and safety. The Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act requires that pesticide users comply with labels. And the FIFRA also grants label authority to states to recognize or regulate pesticide, which is also done by the label. And we allow states to grant emergency pesticide use requests, such as the sulfoxaflor request that the MDA recently received at the request of the soybean growers to combat pest resistance issues that we're facing in southeastern Minnesota. With this language, the Department of Agriculture would not be able to address these kinds of issues for our producers in the future. Other concerns, the department has concerns about changes made in the bills to the Ag Growth Research and Innovation Grant Program. And since the inception of the Agri program, the legislature, the governor, and the department have largely said no to earmarking these dollars. And we've really focused on being able to be flexible and to make investments where we can have good returns on investments in targeted areas. It's been a popular program. We've generated over 4,000 jobs and leveraged $200 million in private investment over the years. And one of the benefits of the program is to be able to set some targets, but then move dollars as demand shifts one way or the other. Our concern is that these bills would basically, particularly the Senate bill, would put the position in place and not allow us to shift dollars between program areas within the Agri program. Though we have concerns about earmarking, we are appreciative of the Senate's position on increasing the Agri administrative funding that the department receives from 4.5% to 6.5%. Typically, grant staff have a portfolio of around 100 grants. The Department of Ag staff currently have a portfolio of 300 grants. And so they're They have a very, very heavy workload. We need to get them some additional help so that we can move at the speed of business. The House version of the bill repurposes $450,000 from the Ag Emergency Account, and the department wants to make sure that we can maintain the Ag Emergency Account to respond to emergencies, but also to be prepared in the event that we face new or emerging diseases such as foot and mouth disease or other things like Palmer amaranth, which we're dealing with right now. And as you know, we faced high path avian influenza in Minnesota, and that outbreak resulted in a $650 million economic loss. But one of the reasons why the department and the Board of Animal Health and the industry were so successful in responding to that outbreak is because we had a secure egg supply plan that was developed about 10 years ago. The other commodity areas don't have that kind of planning. And that's what we as an industry and the department really want to work towards, is developing secure supply plans for all of those various different sectors of our economy. And I know the farmers and the processors and the industry groups, we just recently met last week, in fact, have a commitment to working toward that, and we need the resources to make that happen. With regard to operating costs, as you know, healthcare costs, salaries, continue to increase. Rent costs continue to increase. And just to maintain the same service level for the department that we currently have, an annual operating adjustment of $2.67 million is required in the next biennium. The department was disappointed that these budgets did not include an increase in operating costs for the agency. And, you know, as you know, if the department is asked to absorb that $2.67 million, the general fund obligation of the agency, which is where, you know, we fund our food safety protection, where we fund our laboratory work, dairy inspection and protection, those are the kinds of things that are going to have to absorb a cut in our agency budget. Administrative costs, the noxious weed program, we're really pleased to see that investment in both the House and Senate bills. Combating noxious weeds is an important and critical task for our agency, and we really appreciate both the House and the Senate bills having those funds. However, the lack of funding for the agency to coordinate this program will hamper some of our future responses, particularly around financial assistance, local weed control officers, et cetera. Industrial hemp, we're pleased to see that both bills included funding for Minnesota's hemp industry. We're seeing some considerable growth there, and certainly a lot of interest. We are concerned, however, that the Senate position does not provide funding for MBA's hemp program coordinator, which will be really important. The hemp program coordinator at the department really ensures that we can stay in compliance with the Drug Enforcement DEA's requirements for permitting, et cetera. That's something that we would like to work with you on as we move forward. Also, the department is very supportive of the Senate's creation of the Wolf Livestock Conflict Prevention Program, grant program. But in order to administer any of these kinds of grant programs, we need to receive administrative funding to make those things happen. So that is just a quick synopsis of some of our thoughts on the bill. Again, we appreciate our continued work together and look forward to working with you through the conference committee. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Woolman. Members, questions? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Woolman, I recognize that there's some language in there regarding the pesticides and that gives the department some heartburn. And I think I mentioned to you quite a while ago that, you know, we would certainly try to work out language. Quite frankly, the industry asked the department for over 6 months for clarification of what verification of need meant and got no response. Over 3 weeks ago, I held a meeting with the department and the industry, at which time there was going to be an effort made to reach an agreement, and I know the industry came up with some alternative language. And I guess to be polite about it, this chairman is getting somewhat impatient with the response of the department in that process and working that out. Could you give me an update as to where you feel that is at this point?
Mr. Woolman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, yes, we met, I believe it was 2.5-3 weeks ago in your office. Then we subsequently met with the industry folks and had a good conversation. There, as we left that meeting, the industry folks were going to provide us some compromise language. We received that, I believe, in writing yesterday or earlier today. So we're in the process of reviewing that language as we speak.
Okay.
Other questions? Senator Goggin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is in the same line of discussion here about the pesticide or the label compliance or verification of need. Does this... I guess what I'm curious about is, does this apply verification of need? Does it go all the way down to, like, myself? If I go to Home Depot or Menards and I go get some insecticide to spray on my dandelions and I've got to prove verification of need for that? Is that? Because I guess I'm just concerned that this opens up a whole laundry list of unintended consequences if we go down the road where everybody's got to have a verification of need for applying any kind of pesticide or insecticide.
Mr. Woolman.
Mr. Chair, the language that's in the Senate bill would not allow verification of need. In fact, we believe that it would cause unintended consequences with regard to our pesticide authority at the department. So, you know, pesticide law has always been based on the label, and, you know, basing it on the label is demonstrating compliance and verifying compliance with the label. And so we believe that the language that's currently in the Senate bill goes far beyond the executive order language that I think some are wanting to adjust.
Senator Goggin, follow up.
Well, I guess I'm confused on that because, do you follow up with the homeowners or do you follow up? Is this just strictly to farmers or is this, who does this all apply to, I guess? Does this go to, you know, your lawn care companies that come out and spray your yard or anything like that? I don't know. I'm curious.
And Mr. Woolman, if we didn't have this provisions and you move ahead with your plan, That's, I think, gets to the gist of the question. How do you decide who you start and stop with?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was largely focused to foliar applications in an agricultural setting. I think a lot of farmers are doing these types of things right now. When applicators go out to the field, they're, you know, documenting everything from, you know, wind speed to temperature to, you know, just a wide variety of different indicators as they're going out and making these applications. And, you know, we know that there's an economic threshold for when you should be making an application for soybean aphids, for example, 250 aphids per plant is generally considered based on the science and economic threshold for when you would make an application. This would essentially, just be verifying that you actually went out, you scouted, you verified that there's compliance that there's a need to make this application.
Any follow-up, Senator Gardner? Senator, or Representative Backer, just called you a senator.
Don't swear at me, please don't. Thank you, Bill. I'm a little confused. And why do we need to do this? I'm sorry, Chairman. Why do we need to do this? You know, if the producers are doing already, why are we putting this extra burden on them? That's from what you're saying. Answer the senator's question. It's being done already. Why are we putting the burden? I mean, I know my constituents. They're not just going out and saying, "Oh, let's go spray this." Where is this the cost benefit, which is much better than what we do see in some other parts of the our state, where people, "Well, I got some extra stuff left over. Let's just put it on here." Farmers don't do that. So I just see this as a burden. Can you ask that question? Answer that question, please.
Mr. Womack.
Mr. Chair, I think most people, and probably most of us around this table, would agree that we have challenges when it comes to pollinators. And, there have been documented situations where we're facing pollinator decline across our state. Now, there are a lot of reasons for why that's happening. And, the scientists at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere could give you a better explanation for why that's happening. But one of the reasons is habitat, another is disease and mites, and another reason is pesticides. And so I think what we want to do is ensure that we are providing good information to farmers and our applicators, but also that we're ensuring that there's good stewardship happening, and making sure that there's good stewardship happening across the landscape. And so that's why I believe there's a strong need for verification of need. Our focus is all on education, promotion of good stewardship.
Follow-up?
Senator Becker.
In regards with, I think there is already good stewardship. To say elsewise, I think that's not being fair whatsoever. And to the senators, that's one of the reasons why on the House side we've funded research to see where this pollination problem might be doing. I'm kind of challenged that the agency thinks, hey, the farmers are causing the problem without real facts. There are multiple things, so I just want to, on the record, the constituents I represent are prudent, they're not wasteful, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Having none, thank you, Mr. Woman. I know you'll be around, and we'll be in touch. I appreciate that. Mr. Scogan from AURI, and then Chris Collins on deck. And then there's two more after following Mr. Collins.
So. Mr. Chair.
Logan, you know the routine. Identify yourself for the record. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Hamilton and committee, I'm Dan Scogan. I do government relations work for the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. AURI asked me to come here today to thank you for putting together these two ag bills. And as you start to bring them together as one bill, we just wanted to once again point out a couple of things that AURI is concerned about. First of all, we want to thank you for at least considering a possible increase in our appropriation. AURI has not had an increase since 2013, even though our entrepreneurs in Minnesota are coming up to us with much more complex and much larger requests of our laboratories. We currently have a waiting list on our food and our co-product redevelopment labs. We have over 120 projects going on at any one time now. And last year, the Office of the Legislative Auditor recommended a significant IT upgrade to better record project progress and report outcomes while still protecting our entrepreneurs' IP. ARI returns about 20 to 1 on your investment in money, and we just believe that an investment in ARI is an investment in not only agriculture in Minnesota, but in the entrepreneurs and small business people who are taking agricultural products and adding value to them. Thank you for considering this increase in our appropriation, and I'd stand for questions.
Questions, members? Representative Hamilton.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologize about the
mic. No problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Scogin, Senator Scogin, could you please comment on your budget reserves? And then as far as a nonprofit, what's the guideline as far as how big, or is there a rule of thumb or a guideline on what reserves should be?
That's a great question, and it has come up in several of our committee hearings this year. The guideline for a 501c3 like ARI is typically about a six-month reserve. Most 501c3s are funded on an annual basis. Of course, here we're on biennial, and so we believe that we should have a larger reserve in case we get caught in a situation where we start to have our funding chipped away in that first year. With 120 to 130 clients who are expecting us to follow through on promises made, we carry a reserve. I asked our CFO this morning of about 11 months, so that's a little over $4 million. As I speak, our senior leadership team is having that discussion. They are having a meeting down at the Embassy Suites, and that was on the agenda. And tomorrow our board of directors is going to also address that question. Because both the House and Senate asked that question when we testified this year, we are going to do a better job of coming up with a number. The legislators that we have talked to aren't willing to give us a number. Our fear is that we use, buy down or use some of our reserves, and then we get the question of why our reserves are so low, because they're easier to spend than they are to replace. And so we are conscious of it. We know that it is an ongoing question, and we are working on it.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Scogin, maybe related to that, where do the reserves come from to help establish $4 million or 11 months worth? What are ways that you've been able to build that to be able to...
The way that I understand it, Senator, Mr. Chair, is that when AURI was founded, it was funded with reserves in place, and those have fluctuated some. Before I started working for AURI, there was a time when we struggled to receive federal grants because our reserves were too high, and there was a conscious effort to spend some of those down. And then... And I don't even know what that amount was, but when we have donations mm-hmm. or when we have excess money from clients when they come in and use our labs, sometimes a percentage of that is put back into the reserves. So it fluctuates, not by much. Sometimes when we have to cover a bill or an invoice that we comes in unexpectedly, they'll go to the reserves for that. But it does fluctuate, and I believe it was established, and maybe Mr. Knopf knows better, that it was we were given reserves, I believe, when AURI was formed.
Mr. Knopf, anything to add on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if I can give any detail, but it was, I mean, if I'm funding a 501c3, you do have to make those considerations when you're appropriating money for them. And I think what it was the legislature appropriated money and they didn't spend all of it in those early years, so they could build up those reserves when they were first created.
Okay. Other questions, members?
Chair
Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this maybe is a question for you, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Scogin also could chip in on it. On the side-by-side, page R9, I believe we're talking on the Senate side now, talking about funding with the Agri-Fund. And on the bottom of page R9, the Senate language calls for $6 million for value-added agricultural grants. And my first thought was that's kind of up AORI's line of work. How do you envision that being different, or would AORI have access to those funds as well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson, I think they're separate items, and the $6 million would be under Agri, if I'm recalling correctly. But I'm going to actually ask our Senate counsel to maybe help clarify.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Scogan may want to weigh in on this, too. And, I mean, Agri, this is for development of value-added agricultural products. What they do at ALRI is more the research part of it to help them develop this. I don't know that Agri gives grants directly to individual organizations to build up their systems or whatever. Maybe Mr. Scogan can answer that, but I think this is quite a bit different than their operation.
Mr. Chair, I don't, and members, I don't believe AURI would be eligible to apply for those grants, although we may have an entrepreneur who gets a grant and then comes to us to get the work done.
Mr. Scogan, vice versa, if you're working with an entrepreneur on a value-added product, you also may be able to connect them with a value-added grant to help launch their product to the next level or something like that?
That's a great point, Mr. Chair. Oftentimes, entrepreneurs have run into barriers that they can't get around, and AURI has a great network of others that we can direct them to help them get what they need.
Representative Anderson, does that help clarify it? Or?
Yeah, it does, Mr. Chair.
That, so I think they're both value-added. The $6 million that you referred to would be more for individual grants that the department ultimately would administer, but AURI may help somebody get one, but they wouldn't get it directly.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? Good discussion. Mr. Scogan, I think you got everybody covered for now, so thank you. Mr. Collins, we'll call next. And
who's on deck? Red?
Red. Mr. Rudnecki, Tim Rudnecki is on the deck. So, Mr. Collins, welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you.
And you may proceed. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, members, for your time. My name is Chris Collin, and I'm a lobbyist for the Pesticide Action Network and the Natural Resources Defense Council. Most experts agree that pollinator losses are caused primarily by three factors: lack of foraging area, varroa mites, and pesticides. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture essentially agrees with these findings when they concluded their two-plus-year neonicotinoid review last August. The question we've been asking has been basically this: with 50% honeybee losses in Minnesota the last 2 years, is nearly all the corn seed planted in Minnesota need to be neonic treated? And is this part of a sustainable agribusiness system? We would also contend that clean water, healthy soil mean thriving pollinators. These are all factors in creating and maintaining a sustainable agribusiness system here in the state. A great way to get there is to support the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's original bill language that includes a pollinator protection account and excludes the label compliance language. I've had a chance to talk with all the members of the committee here today and just about all of the members of all the ag committees here at the legislature, and I just want to share with you some of the things that I've heard and things that I think that most folks agree on. And this is what I heard from legislators on the committee. We don't want Minnesota to be an outlier in a way that puts Minnesota farmers at a competitive disadvantage. We agree. We should have a hearing on neonics. That was one thing that we heard, and we wish that would have happened. We need to bring people together and get things done, and this was said within the context of working on the neonic issue, and we believe that to be true. farmers are willing to make changes if they understand what the changes are and those changes make sense. Minnesota has a great interest in sustainable farming. There seems to be no pollinator habitat between here and my district. Rural legislators, several of them, stated the preference for non-neonic seed for soybeans. I heard one story about family farmland with bees where year after year the bees wouldn't live. We agree that's a concern. Do bees like alfalfa? Had a conversation about that. Turns out they do. There's now more than one regional city in greater Minnesota that passed a pollinator-friendly resolution by their city council. And with these things in mind and looking for agreement, can we afford the status quo? I mean, when we look at those 50% losses year in, year out, and we look at the neonics that are going into the ground and into the air that have the side effect of killing pollinators that are vital to agriculture now and in the future. So we're hoping that we can work towards sound policy that protects agriculture, not only for this year's harvest, but for future generations. And I would like to thank Chair Hamilton, his committee, and the House for the language and money for the pollinator habitat and research. But we also support saying no to harmful label compliance language and yes to a permanent pollinator protection account that would be administered by the Department of Agriculture. We see them as being an important partner with the University of Minnesota. And I'd also just like to add that, you know, in listening to some of the earlier discussion, you know, I would say don't overlook or underestimate the value of what appears to be free. Clean water, healthy soil, those add up to happy pollinators, and I think those are signs of a sustainable agriculture system. And also earlier today, I heard the phrase mitigation of risk, and I hope you keep that phrase in mind when you're thinking about pollinators in the state of Minnesota and the positive impact they have on the agricultural business here. Thank you.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Cohen, I really appreciate your thoughtful approach. We've had some, I believe, very constructive conversations. And out of that, you know, was the account that we established to send money to the University of Minnesota. And maybe you can answer these questions, maybe not. One is, can you tell us, as far as pollinator habitat, you talked about the three-prong approach of habitat, mites, and pests. My first question on pollinator habitat, can you share with the committee what proper seed mixture should be planted for native bees and honeybees? That's my first question.
Mr. Chair, straight answer to that is no.
Right.
I am here today without my usual posse of experts that have generally, you know, we've spoken as a group, but my expertise more lies in trying to navigate on behalf of the groups that I work for my way around here rather than the science of a lot of this. So no, I don't know the answer to that. There's a lot of people who are working on that and would be glad to have more discussion later about that.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Cohen, you're absolutely right. And people don't know. And when we were talking to the University of Minnesota, and we have one of the world-renowned experts right there at the U of M, and they too were saying people don't know because the research hasn't been done. And that's why we wanted to take that thoughtful approach to make sure we're invested in research on the habitat side. My second question, and this is on, you brought up the mites piece. Now, the way I understand it, bees are, they travel all across the states, all across the United States to pollinate other areas. Is there any way of knowing if we bring bees out to almond fields or whatever, if they pick up a mite there and bring it back to Minnesota? We just had a long conversation on emerging diseases around shrimp. Is there any way of the Department of Ag, Board of Animal Health, whomever, to be able to track whether or not we're bringing diseases back into the state of Minnesota that's also harming our bees? Do you know the answer to that question?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to say that in answer to the previous question, I don't know the answer, but I do believe there's a fair number of people that have a lot of knowledge about that, and I know that in many cases planting original native prairie is something that pollinators can thrive on. And to answer your second question, the best answer I could give on that here at I'd want to do a little more research to give you a fully accurate answer. But the best answer I could give you right now would be that, for example, in the state of Minnesota, there are bee inspections that are done. I can't cite the statute right now, but they are still being done by the Department of Agriculture for when those bees travel to other states, and most other states have inspections that are conducted. But you do raise a good point. If it has to do with mites coming from other states, I don't know if you need to cross state boundaries to have that concern. I mean, there are plenty of Varroa mites, I'm afraid, just right here in Minnesota.
And Mr.
Chairman,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the leeway here. And Mr. Cohen, and I'm going to apologize for putting you on the spot. You're the only testifier here today. So I apologize for that, but the point that I'm making is we don't know there, and we can bring up somebody from the Department of Agriculture, too, if I'm speaking out of line, but I asked this question, and we don't know for sure if we're transferring disease across the state lines, and you said we had a number of mites here in the state, pressures already, so you would think other states would be very, very concerned if we're transferring hives to other states as well. And my point is, you know, in the pork industry, we have to document every single animal that we move out of the state, every animal, and have vet certificates, et cetera, to make sure that we are not transferring disease. And so the three-prong approach, habitat, we don't know. Mites, we don't know. And all our emphasis are on pesticides and drift. And we reached out to some of the companies that manufacture the neonics and others, and they're working on that drift issue as well. And so we're putting all our effort and all our focus on the pesticide piece, but there's a huge component here that we know absolutely nothing about. And that's what I'm saying. We need to invest in these areas as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Collins,
if I might, I'm not sure if I can agree with your characterization. There are three things. I think they've been fairly well documented in many arenas by many experts over a period of time. And we do know what makes for a good foraging area for bees. I mean, we do know that. We know many of those factors. So that is known. Do we need to learn more? I think we always do, but I think we do have a pretty good idea of what constitutes a good foraging area for bees. We do know that Varroa mites cause a lot of trouble for a lot of bee colonies throughout the country. And that those two things in combination with the pressure of the unintended consequences of pollinators contacting with pesticides, that's where you get that cocktail of all three pressures. When you have those three things in combination, I think many people would agree that that's how you end up with 40 nationally to 50 within the state of Minnesota, 40 and 50% losses for bee colonies year to year.
Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is along the same lines as Chairman Hamilton had in regards to the neonicotinoids and the treated seeds. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned mitigation of risk. And my question in regards to mitigation of risk is, do your beekeepers contact the farmers prior to going out and moving their hives around to see if they've planted any treated seeds, when they planted them, you know, anything like that? So that, I mean, because for the farmer to know when a beekeeper is going to be moving their hives around, it's kind of difficult for them. So I was just wondering if part of your risk mitigation strategies were to contact the local farmers and let them know that, hey, we're looking to come into your area and bring our bees. Have you
and then ask the question, have you put any treated seed down or any pesticide down, and you know, something along that line. I was just curious if your industry does that.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator,
Mr. Collins,
I can't speak for industry. I'm not representing the honey producers, so I can't do that. But I can tell you what I do know. I'm a hobby beekeeper, and I work with a lot of other beekeepers. Now, you can go online, and I believe it's called Bee Watch. There's a voluntary system with a map, and you can look and see everybody who has registered the location of their apiaries. They're on there for the entire state. And from what I hear from, it seems that amongst beekeepers, I can say anecdotally, that there's a wide variety of thought in terms of how people approach these things. And one thing that I have heard is that the kind of the reverse side of letting farmers know where your apiary is the farmer might, and this is where, and let me interrupt my own thought. There's a lot of cases, I think in the vast majority of cases, farmers and beekeepers work together to keep each other happy. But in some cases, a farmer might say, oh, you have your apiary there. I looked it up on Bee Watch, and you might want to move your bees because I'm going to be spraying. And that then it's now it's about beekeepers having to move it might be a sizable apiary in the case of a commercial beekeeper, and having to do that every time there's an application put on the field. But I'm accentuating the negative there. I'm just bringing up what I have heard anecdotally, what some beekeepers are concerned with when they register their apiary locations. My understanding is that in the vast majority of cases, everybody works together and tries to get along.
Follow up, Senator Duggan. Good.
I'm fine.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on that, I see Ms. Place is here from the Department of Ag. Yeah, the Drift Watch program has been in effect for a while, and we passed legislation that that if a beekeeper wants to be compensated for his losses, they have to register with the Drift Watch. And last year, I asked for the numbers, and I believe there were only two cases where a beekeeper was compensated for a bee loss, but I haven't seen the newest year's numbers. I'm wondering if anybody from the department has those numbers yet from 2016. To see what happened with Drift Watch. I don't know what they are. I haven't seen them yet.
Mr. Collins, do you know, or Ms. Place from the department, or somebody? No?
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, Representative Anderson.
Just say your name for me.
Oh, this is Whitney Place. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Agriculture. Representative Anderson, this year we haven't had any bee claims.
Okay. Does that answer your question? Follow up?
That's interesting. And just a footnote about beekeepers and farmers getting along, and I think I've shared this with members of the House. I'm a farmer, and I have a beekeeper that has bees in my pasture. And one year he didn't put his bees out until after I had planted corn. If this corn dust thing is a cause of bee loss. And he said one year it worked real well, and next year it made no difference at all in terms of bee losses and that kind of thing. But I think it's interesting that there were no claims turned in this past year and only two the year before. So I have to wonder how big an issue it is, at least in terms of the corn planter dust, that we aren't seeing more claims turned in. And it's very interesting. So thank you for that, and that's the end of my question.
Any further questions, members? Mr. Collins, thank you for your testimony, and Ms. Place, thank you. Two more testifiers. Tim Rudnicki, and then... who's the last one? Leah. Oh, Leah Gardner, you're on deck. So that'll be our last one. So members, we'll finish this and then final comments and conclude. So
Welcome to our committee. Identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, Compreese, my name is Tim Rudnicki, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. I'm here to urge this committee to provide the maximum amount of funding possible for the biofuel infrastructure provision in the omnibus bill. And while I understand you're confronted with many interests competing for a limited number of tax dollars, I offer four reasons why maximum funding for the biofuel infrastructure is a prudent use of tax dollars and good for Minnesotans. First, based on the most current data from the Energy Information Administration, Minnesota imported 2.14 billion gallons of gasoline in 2015. Importing billions of gallons of gasoline into Minnesota means energy dollars are drained from Minnesota. We don't have any fossil fuels. We don't have any petroleum in the state of Minnesota. Funding biofuel infrastructure, on the other hand, will allow for the use of more renewable biofuel, which is made right here in Minnesota, and thereby will keep more energy dollars in Minnesota. Second, when Minnesotans have access to more renewable biofuels made right here in Minnesota, they buy it. According to data from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, E15 sales this February closed out at about 856,000 gallons. That's about 3.4% higher than in January, and compared to last year at the same time, 65% higher. Third, an investment in biofuel infrastructure produces tangible positive outcomes. Through a cooperative program with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, we've demonstrated how to successfully work with fuel retailers. We're not looking for a handout, but instead are looking for a helping hand to make E15 available to Minnesotans. Thus far, E15 is now available at 138 locations in Minnesota. Finally, each tax dollar invested in biofuel infrastructure will yield multiple social, environmental, and economic benefits for Minnesota. And I'll give you a few examples. A $12 million investment, which is based on the original funding amount in the Senate and House bill, is projected by ABF Economics to support 276 jobs and contribute $25.5 million to household income in Minnesota. When Minnesotans use renewable biofuel made right here in Minnesota, they cut pollution. If, for example, we had just add 5% more ethanol, that would be the E15, it would cut greenhouse gas emissions by an additional 358,000 metric tons annually. And if we use the EPA greenhouse gas calculator, that's equivalent to removing 75,368 vehicles from the roads. And lastly, a $12 million investment holds the potential to generate $35.9 million in gross domestic product in Minnesota and to contribute $1.4 million in state and local taxes. In closing, for all these social, environmental, and economic reasons, I urge you to provide as much funding as possible for the biofuel infrastructure provision. And I thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments, members? Thank you. You covered it well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree.
Ms. Gardner, Leah Gardner. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leah Gardner, and I am Good Food Access Campaign Manager at the American Heart Association. First, I want to thank you all for your hard work this session on the Omnibus Bill. Speaking on behalf of the Minnesotans for Healthy Kids Coalition and the Good Food Access Campaign, we appreciate Chair Hamilton and the House Committee's recommendation to invest in the Good Food Access Program. With bipartisan support at the legislature, this program has a broad statewide support, including a range of partners from health, anti-hunger advocates, to the Farmers Union, to economic development leaders such as regional development commissions. In fact, recent polling by the commission by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota demonstrates an interest in understanding by Minnesotans that healthy food access is needed across the state. 72% of Minnesotans would be likely to choose healthier food if more options were available in their communities, and nearly 63% of respondents also indicated that they support the state of Minnesota appropriating funding to increase access to healthy and affordable food. Ironically, despite our strong agricultural base, Minnesota is ranked 7th worst in the nation for healthy food access. That means that almost a third of Minnesotans are impacted by this issue. Over 340,000 Minnesotans face income and distance barriers to accessing healthy and affordable foods. Speaking from my personal perspective, there is nothing more important than making sure families have access to a range of nutritious foods. As a child, my parents struggled to make ends meet, and we ate what was available. As a mother, I understand that we would all go to any lengths necessary to feed our children what they need to survive. But to have access to the foods that they need to best thrive can be a tremendous challenge. Until recently, we struggled to find the foods that, we struggled to find foods my son could eat. And that's due to a number of diet issues and developmental delays. Access to a wide range of foods that he could consume properly was critical to his ability to thrive. Thankfully, our family had the means and ability to acquire a number of specific food items recommended by his doctors. As a result, he has grown from a quote-unquote failure to thrive baby to a healthy, happy toddler. Unfortunately, food access challenges are increasingly common for Minnesotans, especially children and seniors. Of the Minnesotans facing distance barriers to full-service grocery stores, 1 in 4 are children and 1 in 5 are seniors. It's critical that we address food access challenges for the well-being of all Minnesotans. In addition to saving the state money with improved health of Minnesotans, the Good Food Access Program provides an opportunity to advance economic development in communities that need it most by supporting food enterprises that create jobs and help bring locally grown food to market. Today happens to be the last day to apply for the first round of resources available through the Good Food Access Program, and based on what we've heard from the Department of Agriculture, the response has been exceeding expectations, both in terms of quantity and quality of applications coming in. This reflects the tremendous need to fully fund this program. I thank you for your consideration. As budget negotiations progress, I urge the committee to maintain an investment in this critical program. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gardner. Members, any questions? Having none, you covered it all. Thank you, Ms. Gardner. And members, that concludes the list of the people that I'd asked to testify. If there is anybody here, is there any other public testimony, somebody that wants to say something that didn't get to, please let us know real shortly. Otherwise, we'll be concluding. So let our staff up here or Paige know if you want real soon or come forward. Anybody? No. Seeing none. Members, good time for any final thoughts or questions if you have as we went over. Otherwise, we'll conclude and continue digesting. Yeah, I'll do that. And members, Chair Hamilton's reminding me next meeting will be, of course, under his gavel, but at the call of the chair, probably after we get budget targets. Would be when we'd anticipate the next conference committee. So, any comments on members? Otherwise, we'll just go forward and adjourn. So. Very good. Having no further discussion, this conference committee is adjourned.